of being reporter for Dan as well.
Next episode is active.
Yeah. Except for I don't think we should start with the end of slides. Give me a second to actually start my slide deck. All right, so everybody ready? So my name's John-Mark Gurney. I am a FreeBSD committer, and I am now a consultant doing my own work. But I will be presenting optimizing Jelly performance. So the question is why do we need to improve Jelly performance? First of all, you know, if there's various different reasons that when I set up an original box to do a couple years ago, it was a ZFS box. I decided, you know, with all the recent NSA wiretapping, you know, if I want to send back a drive for RMA or do any, you know, or stuff like that, I would prefer to have my data encrypted on the hard drive. And so I decided that I was going to do Jelly encryption on my hard drive. So I had acquired a server, 6-core server, and deployed Jelly encryption, and the performance was very, very slow. I think I was only getting like 150 megabytes per second, and this was on 8 spindles with the 6 cores. All 6 cores were completely saturated, you know, and it was a modern like 2.8 gigahertz CPU, and it's like, I should be getting better performance than this. That's completely unacceptable performance. And so when I first deployed this, I was using software encryption. And after doing some research, because I had purchased an AMD Opteron, I knew about the ASNI instructions that Intel had done, but I hadn't realized that AMD had deployed it in some of their processors. So after a little bit of investigation, I was like, what if my processor does have it? It turned out it did. I enabled ASNI, and I saw almost no improvement in performance. And I'm like, the company that I had previously worked for, Cryptography Research, they actually did a review of the ASNI instructions, so I knew that the performance that I should get from using these instructions should be significantly faster than using software crypto. And I'm like, why is that happening? And, you know, I knew that the performance should be greater than a gigabyte per second for the stuff. I mean, sure, disk system has overhead, and there's a lot of other things that can impact performance, but 150 megabytes per second was just unacceptable. And obviously, if it's slow, people won't use it. You know, if they need to do a gigabyte per second to their storage array and they can only get 100 megabytes per second, then they're going to have to turn off encryption. It's just not acceptable to be slow. And through a little bit of work also to try to make it more maintainable. So one of the main encryption algorithms used in Jelly is AES. So I'll go over what is AES. AES is a basic block cipher mode. It takes in 16 bytes of input. It permutes the data it does not permute the bits, but it actually generates another 16 bytes that is a one-to-one mapping. AES is what is called a PRP, a pseudo-random permutation. And that means that there will always be a one-to-one mapping from the input to the output. And when you're doing ciphers, this is very important, because if it was like a PRF, which is what most hash functions is, you would not be able to reverse it. And so So the basic structure is they do an add round key, which is a simple XOR of the first 16 bytes of the key schedule, and then each additional round after that is a combination of sub-bytes, which is a simple, each byte is basically looked up in a table of 256. It can get a little bit more, but I'm sure not too many people are interested. Shift rows, shifts things around, makes the columns around, and then again you add the round key. And depending upon how many, your key size will determine round keys and other stuff. And then the final round is slightly different in that mixed columns does not happen. So there's different things that can affect the performance of AES. One of them, there's different cipher modes, because the standard mode that you've always seen, actually, now I think about it, I should have thrown in the, how many people have seen the Penguin ECB picture? So if you've seen it, it's basically they take a PNG of the Linux Penguin and they encrypted it in ECB mode, and you view it, and yes, all the colors are wrong, but you can actually still make out that it's a penguin. And that's because the common colors were in the picture, like the solid background, got all encrypted to the same value. And so you can still see that. And so ECB is not, I was just reading on Twitter the other day that people were like, you know, why do people include ECB modes in crypto libraries? Well, it's also useful for building other cipher modes. And so there's a couple of different other, and since we're actually talking about disencryption, the other thing that becomes important is sector size. Because every time you do pass through various stacks and layers, as you know, there's a certain fixed cost overhead. And by increasing sector size, you actually amortize the cost over, and you can do better pipelining. And then obviously key size, larger key size, more rounds, and then it comes out being slower. So one of the things is, as I talked about, it was slow. The thing is like, if you benchmark OpenSSL, this is the performance numbers that you were getting on various different modes. And I'll talk about the modes in a little bit. So the blue line is CBC encrypt. Part of the reason why, and this is actually, this baseline performance is enabling AES&I. By default, if you just do OpenSSL speed, AES 128 CBC, it will use some built-in C assembly, but not AES&I version. So you need to do -EVP to actually get real AES&I performance. And so this demonstrates that with different cipher modes, you can get dramatically different performance. And this also relates to the different sector sizes. If you use a really small sector size, the overhead becomes too great, and you don't actually get as much performance. So Jelly has both AES-CBC and XTS modes implemented in it. As you can see, the XTS mode is much more ideal than using the CBC mode when using AES&I. So next question, as I was talking, is different cipher modes. The reason why there is the big performance degradation in CBC mode is the fact that you cannot end up pipelining CBC while you can with XTS. And the reason why you cannot pipeline CBC is that after each block encryption, you need the output ciphertext to actually XOR onto the next plain text in order to derive the next block encryption layer. As you can see with XTS, and this will be appearing, for those who are in the know, this will be appearing on Wikipedia. I created it just for today. The XTS lock cipher mode is actually tweakable. So what is commonly used in this case, I is inputted as the like sector number into another lock cipher algorithm. And then this is a simple Galois LFSR increment for each round, and then that is used as to XOR plain text, encrypt, and then XOR the tweak factor again on to generate the ciphertext. And as you can see, each of these block cipher out encryption or decryption blocks, depending upon which way you're going, is now independent. And this Galois LFSR can be made very cheap. And because of this, we can now actually pipeline the AES encryption and decryption modes and achieve some of the very good thing. Then there's the other, as I mentioned and showed some numbers, the counter mode is similar to, oh, sorry, yes, question.
Quick question.
Yes.
Why is she losing a lot of the encryption-ness by going between the CBC to
So that, well, it's a combination of the LFSR. It could theoretically be predicted, but the thing is that A, the block cipher, the attacker won't know key two, so they'll not know that. The other thing is that even if they were, you know, even if they have the plain text and the ciphertext, they also don't know what this block encryption layer will be. And so they cannot really determine what the tweak factor is. So even if they were able to, have both the plain text and the ciphertext, you know, be able to write their own file, it would be, I'm not a cryptographer, so I can't say exactly, it would be very difficult to get the tweak factor and do that. And also, anyways, it doesn't matter. There's not too much because the real protection is actually occurring in the encryption, and the tweak factor is just to prevent like the standard ECB attack. With CBC, if you corrupt the ciphertext, you only actually corrupt the current block and the next block. And then after that, because the next ciphertext blocks is the correct one and you do the XOR for decryption, then all future ciphertext blocks are now magically healed again. So even if you, even if an attacker was to corrupt the ciphertext, you'd only have two blocks of data that was corrupted. Does that answer enough of your? So then I also bring in counter mode because that is commonly used, but you also, again, have to be very careful when using counter mode because if you use the same counter again, very bad things will happen because now an attacker can simply take your output ciphertext, the two ciphertexts, XOR them together, and they'll get the XOR difference between your plain text. And that is not at all very good. Because now you can, and especially if the attacker is able to control one of the two ciphertexts, because now they can generate the data and actually say, oh, well, since I know this plain text, I got the encryption, XOR the two together, I now have this encrypted, then I XOR my known plain text back on, and now I have the plain text out. So, but luckily, Jelly does not implement counter. It could theoretically do it securely, but it's not. So, as I mentioned, instruction pipelining is very important to how AES achieves its performance. And as I mentioned, I was very puzzled as to why the original AES XTS encryption did not perform very well. And I knew that, so I decided to look at the code, and one of the big problems was that it was only processing one block at a time. And so normally, if you just, depending upon what architecture you're on, the performance latencies on these can range from like 4 to about 7 cycles. And some of the architectures have the inverse throughput of an instruction being in about 1 or 2 cycles per instruction. And so that means that, you know, if you're doing a stand, you know, as this diagram shows, this is assuming a 7-cycle latency with a dispatch issue of every cycle. And as you can see, we've now done 3 blocks in literally 2 more clock cycles than if we had done them serially. And so now we have done 3 times as much work with just a very marginal increase. And the Intel paper actually talks about that. Processors have significantly improved since the original Intel paper. The original Intel paper recommended 8 rounds, which is what I actually ended up implementing to pipeline, but I think now with most modern processors, 4 may actually be better because almost all the modern processors are like a 4-cycle latency with one instruction per cycle. So that gives you a huge boost. Yes.
Is this something that you were able to measure?
What do you mean by measure?
Were you able to measure the efficacy of your pipelining with one implementation versus the other? Do you know how many stalls there were, how many times the pipeline was?
I did not actually do any of those low-level measurements, but like one of my very first implementations, I did do that, but I forget if I have the slide. But when I actually finally did all of my changes, I pulled the original XTS algorithm out into user land, so that way I could get rid of all the kernel overhead. I didn't have to recompile kernels, do all of that stuff. The original algorithm was performing at about 150 megabytes per second in user land, and the original my original pipelining boosted that to over a gigabyte per second, and then with some other tweaks, like with the improved GAWA LFSR and other stuff, I got that improved to over 2 gigabytes per second in user land on the same on a 3.4 gigahertz machine. So the pipeline already showed significant improvement. I forget exactly how detailed my LFSR diagram, which I'll be talking about in a second, how it was. But I do actually also use PMC stat to actually measure performance, but I didn't actually do any of the really other crazy counters that they have, which is like, you know, how many cycles were not actually dispatching instructions or anything like that. But it would be interesting to see though. So the other part, as I mentioned, is the, if we go back, if you guys remember the XTS, between every block, we actually have to compute a tweak factor. And this is alpha, which is the primitive element in the GAWA field, which is pretty much always 2. And so that is what makes it a GAWA LFSR. But in order to compute that, we need to do this. And the original code was not very efficient at doing this. It was doing a byte at a time and using a bunch of branches. So, I mean, well, it works, you know. Then PJD did a little bit of improvement where he decided to actually improve it to using 64 bits at a time. So now we only have one branch and we're using a lot less instructions. So my friend Mike Hamburg, I was actually talking with him, who helped me a lot of this, and he actually came up with a new interesting way of handling the computing the tweak factor using SSE instructions. Since I'm using ASNI, I know that I have access to these SSE instructions, and you know, even with this code, you know, you have to do a load and an AND and, you know, shift and do a lot of other stuff. So with his help, it turns out that we can actually do a simple GAWA LFSR increment in 5 SSE instructions. And so this is the code that we actually end up using. We load up a constant, we do a shuffle, we do a shift right by 31, and that with the alpha mask, and then we do a shift left by 1, and then we XOR the results on. And to give this a little bit more of a better diagram, we have this picture. So the input is this. What happens is that we shuffle the words around, which is basically, turns out to be a simple left rotate by 32-bit words. Then we do the shift right arithmetic by 31. And that basically ends up splatting the entire high bit over all the registers. So now the register, if the high bit was a 0 or 1, now that word contains either a 0 or 1. And then now we add the AND mask. The first few 3 words are all 1s, because if it's a 1, we AND it with a 1. We've now carried the high bit from one word to the next word. Now the next part is that if you end up shifting out, the way the GAWA LFSR is implemented, if you end up shifting out this high one out is a 1, then you need to XOR, you need to basically do a reduction step, and that reduction step is XORing the constant 87 into the low byte. And so if we end up shifting out a high one out of the input, this will actually come out ending to 87. If there is a one, if it wasn't, it'll be zero and no harm, no foul. Then we do the shift. We XOR these two together, and now we have done a LFSR increment. And so, and that ends up with the intrinsics that used here. It compiles down to basically five instructions as opposed to the tens of instructions otherwise used. So one of the decisions that I made when I was developing this software was that I was going to go use intrinsics. And there, if you look at all the code out there, everybody's doing hand assembly. OpenSSL has a crazy Perl script to generate its assembly, and it's like, I really don't want to deal with that. Importing it into FreeBSD would be a pain. We don't have Perl in base, so then I'd still have to input the Perl, but then I'd pre-generate it. You know, we can't regenerate it, all that other stuff. So maintainability to me means intrinsics. Yes, it's intrinsics is almost like assembly, but you're only using assembly for the key parts that you want, and the rest of it you're letting the compiler. It does turn out that you do not get the same performance using intrinsics as you would use hand-rolled assembly, but the question is that degradation in performance managed by the maintainability? The other interesting thing is that I can now use the exact same code on both i386 and AMD64 boxes. I do not have to have different assembly source files because all of the code compiles exactly the same. I don't think I've mentioned it, but the data type used to represent the 128-bit data types are exactly the same between that. So if you look at the current ASXTS code in FreeBSD, the only differences between i386 and AMD64 right now is the key scheduler, and that's only because I didn't bother to improve it yet. So one of the other advantages of the intrinsics is that it actually works around an ABI limitation with that AMD64 has. AMD64 can only pass in, I forget if it, darn it, my notes are not showing. It's either 4 or 8 registers. And as you know, if any other additional arguments have to be passed on the stack. And so even if you're calling a really hot function that's like doing 8 encryptions at a time, you're now going to be spilling out, possibly putting some of your inputs onto a stack. And also the return values, you can actually only pass back, even though the ABI allows 2 return XMM registers. Yes?
Chuck, I'm just wondering why you would be comparing out-of-line assembly to intrinsics, not inline assembly, because there's no limitation on the number of register arguments you can pass to inline assembly as long as you have
That is correct. The reason why I'm comparing it is that almost everybody uses out-of-line assembly for all of their routines. And so the inline assembly, you still have the same difficulty in passing. I've actually never, and I will admit, I've never actually tried to do, you know, eight argument inline assembly stuff. So it is possible that we could do that.
That should just work.
Yeah. Also a lot of the inline assemblies, they actually do like either an entire crypto algorithm or whatever and don't do the builds up. And so this way I can actually have simple building blocks and stuff. So, but yeah, that is a good point. So as I mentioned, with the inline functions, we're actually able to bypass that limit. And the ASXTS code actually had an interesting thing where they actually used a common crypt function that passed an argument whether it was an encrypt or decrypt function. And so by being able to use inline intrinsics, I was able to actually have both encrypt and decrypt registers map up, and so there was less reorganization. And I, as you said, I think the inline assembly would be able to do the same thing. So, as I mentioned, the assembly, there's a few pros, you know, tighter instruction scheduling. You know, one of the big problems, one of the bugs that somebody else discovered in my original code was that there were a few cases where the buffers would actually be unaligned. And being able to get the, both Clang and GCC, when you compile code that references the 128-bit data type, it actually always issues a load that requires the data to be aligned, and it will fault if the data is not. And that's part, though, why there's any difference, because almost all the processors execute the same, almost exactly the same, and there's only a slight penalty for unaligned. I'm not quite sure, but they choose to do the difference. And so there's, and then the other advantage was that GCC did not support ASINI intrinsics. And let's see here, FreeBSD at the time that I did this work, which started, oh, yes. Yes, I'm not sure which GCC first started to support ASINI, but since we're using 4.2.1, and actually the real problem was that it's our binutils that doesn't support ASINI, not our GCC, because even if you were to use like inline assembly, it gets passed to whatever binutils we have compiled. So when I did all of this work, GCC was still considered a supported architecture, even though i386 and AMD 64 had switched over to Clang. And there were still a number of people who, for various reasons, chose to remain compiling on GCC, and I did not want to be the person to leave them out hanging in the wind. So as I mentioned, Clang, everything just worked, and as I mentioned, our GCC and binutils is very, very old, and we're hopefully going to get rid of that soon. So I had to add ASINI support, and actually at the same time I added PCL mol QDQ, which is a carryless multiply with a double to a quad double. And so once I added ASINI instructions into binutils and wrote the appropriate intrinsics header file, we could now actually use -MAS on GC just like we could on Clang. And it wasn't too bad, but here's the original assembly that was used in order to generate to do the encryption. And this was actually just, I believe, this is just their kind of counter ECB type mode. And I forget if they did have slightly more complicated instructions, but as you might notice, ASENC was commented out and replaced with a byte string. And this was because of the fact that our binutils did not support ASINI instructions. And so in order to get the code to work and compile, the original committer actually had to use a byte string. I'm not sure how he did it, compiled it with Clang or whatever, or hand assembled it and got that. And as you can see, we end up loading our data, or actually no, we load up our, we load up the pointer to the IV and make sure that the, up there is where we load the pointer to the IV, and if the if the pointer to the IV is null, we skip over it. Otherwise, we load the data from the IV, apply XOR on, and then we now do start applying the round keys. This actually applies the first round key, increment, do a round, decrement the round counter. If we still have rounds to go, do it over again, and then do the last one. And again, as you can see, AES ENC last was also a byte string. And obviously there's a return at the end that I didn't want to make the font too small for you guys. So as I implied, and you've actually seen a little bit of the intrinsic code provides a 128-bit data type, and there are a few different ones, but the one, since we're all doing integer math, I use the underscore underscore M128i. They appear to like their underscores and their M's and all of that namespaces. And then depending upon some of the intrinsics are built implemented as built-ins, and part of that is in order to properly handle constant propagation, because some of the arguments to an intrinsic will actually be a constant or a computed constant. But it turns out that I think it's at least with GCC, if you inline assembly, if it's a computed constant, it won't know actually, if you go through enough layers, it won't know to actually be able to fold it into a constant. And so there is still the issue that I think it's PCL mole QDQ. If under other in circumstances, because I did not go through the work of making PCL mole QDQ a built-in, there are certain cases where you won't successfully compile it because of the constant folding. It's not there. And so let's see here. Features must be enabled by the compiler flag. The AES instructions are enabled by -m AES, and the PCL mole QDQ is enabled by -m PCL mole. And as I mentioned, there's no easy way to handle unaligned data in intrinsics. And by easy, meaning just set an attribute, this data, this pointer is now unaligned. And this would also be very useful in some of the ARM work and other stuff, but they, even though other architectures also have the unaligned loads, for some reason none of the compilers have the flag.
What happens if you set attribute aligned one on
the ARM? I believe I've tried it, and even though you set it, both Clang and GCC ignores it. I actually have commented out one of the aligned things and commented on that. So that would actually make my life easier if both GCC and Clang supported it, but that can't happen until we actually do GCC. And another way that you can actually work around this is, I actually end up using both of these depending upon their uses, is actually telling the compiler that it's a structure, that the M128i data type is actually in a structure, and that the structure is packed. And by declaring that it's packed, it now tells the compiler, I have no clue what the alignment is. And it manages to do the proper load instructions. So finally, yes. Did somebody have a question?
The language spec says this is a pointer to this structure. We assume to follow it. So you're kind of violating the language spec.
That is correct, but also like the packed attribute is not part of the C99, C11 spec.
Yeah,
so it's
packed.
Correct.
We know nothing now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
no, I agree. It was a hack. I mean, I could have rewritten the code so that instead of using a packed structure, I did all these separate loads, and it would have done the exact same thing, but I'm using this hack since I know it works, and it provides much more concise code. And part of the reason why I chose to use intrinsic was to get concise code. So. And so this is... a single round AES encryption. I do not actually show the 8-round, partly because the code would be a little bit longer. But now, instead of using that assembly file that you saw earlier, this is now what it looks like sans the IV application. And I don't know about you, but if I'm going to have to look at code, I'd much rather look at this as opposed to the assembly. So getting all of the code together, tested, you know, in user land and doing all that other stuff is all fine and dandy, but the whole point of this project was to make it run faster in the kernel. And the next question, so it turns out that the kernel build instructure does not have does not have the standard header files that you do in user land. And our standard kernel does not have the intrinsic headers because, well, all the intrinsics are SSE. You're not supposed to use floating point in the kernel, except for when with special work you can. So the question is now we have all of this intrinsics, how do we make it compile? Luckily, with BSD's config, there's actually a separate file that lets us call out special instructions on how to compile a C file. And so we do the really naughty thing of removing no standard inc from the kernel compile. And so this flag no standard inc means don't include the standard include header files. The reason why I can get away with this is I made sure that the API for this one file uses no kernel interfaces and has a very limited API such that I don't need to depend upon any of the kernel header files that could possibly pollute the compile, and I come up with just the right amount. And also, the default compile is actually 0.2, and in some of my testing, 0.3 got better performance, but when I was actually recently working on AES-GCM, I actually found out that 0.3 gave me worse performance than 0.2, but another fun problem of compilers. So I have to enable MNX, SSE, and the AES instructions. And so now we are able to, with this in there, we are now able to compile our code. So the next thing is performance testing. How many people know of Ministat? Ministat is a utility that PHK wrote a number of years ago. If you do any basic benchmarking or whatever, it is a very simple to use utility to actually tell, did the changes that I make actually make a difference in the performance? Because a lot of times, you know, if you're doing a build, timing your build world or whatever, the times will vary from run to run. And it may look like they improve, but actually it turns out that the variation between the build world times or whatever you're measuring is so significant that you can't, it looks like it improved, but actually the variance is too high that you cannot actually say that my changes improved timing. So with Ministat, it's a very basic utility that you provide it a simple file with numbers, and each file that you provide is basically a set of numbers for one configuration option, and it will compare the result, average results and standard deviations and that sort between each files and say, was there an improvement? So in this case, the first file, the fastest one was X, which was the ASNI with, I believe, sync disabled. And luckily, this one, the variation was not very good, so you probably could tell by eyeballing it that it was, but now we actually have at 95% confidence that the other two performed significantly worse than what we are. So FreeBSD now actually includes this as part of the base distribution. It is no longer in tools, which is very useful. So if you need to do any benchmarking, always do at least 3 to 5 runs. Pass your data through Ministat to confirm that. So this is based, you know, you can use this for simple testing and other stuff. Now the next question is, how do you identify various hotspots and other stuff? And this is where PMC stat comes in to being helpful. PMC, a few years ago I was at my work and I wanted to do some performance evaluation, and it's like, I know FreeBSD has PMC counters, and I was like, well, with PMC counters, the overhead is virtually zero. You can run it and you don't get a slowdown, but if you run like the standard -pg compile with gprof, the performance can be 5-10 times slower, which if you're doing timing, net things that are timing critical, you basically can't do it with gprof. And annoyingly, Linux at the time, and I think they still do not enable it by default. But in FreeBSD, we actually have userland ability to call in PMC stats so it's available to all users, and it just works and gives you really awesome data. And so we can generate PMC stat data with this, and the dot test perf was my test program that I was doing. And so this, there's, as you mentioned, there's a lot of different, there's lots of different counter statistics that you can do. You can get like L1 cache misses, L2 cache misses, like branch stalls. There's very many different types of counters that you can use, and it gives you much better idea of what to do. So this is a simple sampling of when the machine was running that we weren't running the halt, i.e. idle. One of the problems that I ran into was that PMC stat has different output formats. It can actually output GPROF format, but apparently I ran the tool too long, I created too many samples, and GPROF has, I believe, a 16-bit limit to all the counts for the various things. And well, I had a few that were larger than that, so I could not use GPROF. But luckily, CallTree, or the CallTree format, which is used by KCacheGrind, came to the rescue. And so this is, once you generate your statistics, and you now convert it into the appropriate CallTree output. How many people here have seen KCacheGrind? And so it gives you very pretty graphics. This is one of them. I'll pull up another in a little bit. I'll actually show a demo. So this may look very confusing, but this is basically the idle thread. This is actually, if you might notice, ASNI ENC8. That's my eight block encryption. So this is basically all the code that ASNI was doing. This was the idle thread. Oh, I should actually say, this is actually the area is about how much time each of the functions and the part, and they're layered into each other, that it consumes. So these big blocks of idle are this specific function consuming time, while and then the blocks within it actually denote what the child function calls are. And so this one, you can kind of see this is highlighted. When I was probing around, I happened to note, if I hadn't been running this, I didn't even notice that there was this other thread, which was crypto ret proc, was consuming about, when adjusted, about 15% of the CPU. And as far as I know, it was like, why would I be running this other thread that I had no idea? And so upon further investigation, it turns out that the ASNI thread, even though the ASNI crypto, open crypto driver was doing calls synchronously, it was not actually telling the Open Crypto framework that it was doing all of its work synchronously. And so when it actually did all of its work and returned, the Open Crypto driver, in order to help avoid locking issues, was actually scheduling another thread to do the callback. And so this is based, so there was about 15% CPU used just to switch to another thread to run a little bit of code and then switch back. And so if, I'm not sure, when I enabled that flag in my performance testing, I saw about a 27% increase in performance, which just by literally adding a flag to the initialization, and I was quite surprised. And other performance, I will admit, Flame Graphs has been around for a while, but I saw them for the first time yesterday, so I had to generate this one real quickly. I did some, another very nice thing about FreeBSD is that the Geom framework makes layering block very well, and one of the blocks that PJD wrote was G0. And all it is basically a source of zeros or any other thing you want, and a sync. And so it takes a lot of the disk and other processing out. Like even MD, even though it is has very similar modes, this is even lighter weight than MD. And so with this is very similar to the call graph. And I'll actually show you, the nice thing is the flame graph will, if you actually have the full SVG version in your browser, you can actually mouse over the various components and actually see how much percentage of time each of them are using. And so these are, got to disable witness, otherwise your performance will suck. Limit ourselves to jelly threat, to one thread. There, I need to work on that. I'll have another slide about that, but the number of threads used, there are benefits to using multiple threads. Like if G0, if you're, you're accessing the same jelly volume on multiple times, having multiple threads can be beneficial. But at the same time, if you have 8 disks like my original ZFS file system did, and Jelly launches 6 threads because you have a 6-core box for all 8 disks. Oh, and by the way, your root's also encrypted, so there's another 2. Your swap's also encrypted. Your ZIL file is encrypted. Suddenly you have a machine with 100 threads doing Jelly encryption, and all of them are going to be competing for the CPUs. And so by being able to set Jelly threads down to 1 on those machines, you're already getting the multi-core performance by the multi-disk access. And so in this case, I just did some tests on my AMD A10 box that runs at 3.4 gigahertz that boosts up to 4 gigahertz. I am able to get about 900 megabytes per second. Yes?
So you're looking at about a 6 times improvement from where you started.
Yeah.
How much of that was due to the change in the cipher versus the order of the time processing versus the built-in?
So my original test was actually using XTS. So there was no actually change in cipher. Okay. So it was all this like 6x plus was all seen purely due to pipelining and the LFSR increase and the sync increase changes.
Okay. Can you say a little bit more about the use of the 128 built-in and why it helps? I understand the byte to 8-byte processing, and you expect linear there.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a bit confused about the 128 on a 64-bit machine.
Oh, what do you...
What is that built-in, what is usually the built-in do for you at the processor level?
Okay, so, well, so one of the things is like with the LFSR, you know, now you're doing, like, with if you're doing a 64-bit LFS, you're talking about the LFSR crank where going from 64 to 128. Well, first of all, less instructions, because with the 64, now you have to do 2 XORs, you have to do a few shifts and tests and other stuff in order to do that. Also, the other thing is that we're already, if we have all of our data already in XMM registers, if we do a 64-bit, we have to actually like spill it to the stack in order to actually transfer it into a 64-bit register and back again. One of the things with using intrinsics and other stuff, basically the data path is entirely in XMM registers. We do not actually touch any of the 64-bit registers through the data path from the time that we load it from memory to the time that we've done all of our work to the time we write it out.
So
SSH uses... Yes, yeah, the XMM. Okay, sorry. Well, no, the SSE2 registers are called XMM. Well, there's also YMM, but yeah, it they are the SSE2 registers or whatever. So yeah. So the performance was... I'm now actually getting decent enough performance and other stuff. There are a few things left for improvement on this. One of the things is that only the people who are using the open crypto calls directly are actually improved. There are various calls that are using direct calls to Rindal encrypt that will not see this. I'd like to see that change. Part of the problem is handling FPU context saves when you're in a non-sleepable context, which is most of those cases, becomes a little bit difficult because now you have to spill like about a kilobyte of context somewhere and you can't allocate memory. There's actually one of the issues that I've noticed is that under certain cases, Jelly does large memory allocation. And by large memory allocation, I'm talking greater than 4 kilobytes. And in FreeBSD, we do not have any zones that are greater than 4K, which means that we have to do a large page allocation, which means that we have to do IPIs to shoot down TLBs and other really big nasties. And so by switching, I'm seeing about 4 or 5% consumption in malloc and free. And I believe switching to a UMA zone or something similar would take that to basic virtually zero. And so that would be another thing. Believe it or not, it looks like key schedule is actually consuming a decent amount of time. And so we could actually pipeline the two since for that. And I also have some somewhat unrelated to this, but I'm also working on some ASGCM improvements and adding that to the crypto. And I believe, at least in my case, the last big performance problem that I have on my ZFS Jelly encryption is that I chose to use SHA-256 for all of my checksums, partly to have pseudo authentication on my, since I'm running a little bit of time, I'm not gonna expand upon that, but you can talk to me later about that. But SHA-256 actually turns out to be very slow, and I think this now in my application becomes the long pole in the tent, actually significantly more than AS, so. All right, so any questions that, David, if you, out. Yeah.
You said that you lose on the tight interruption scheduling when you use the internet.
Yeah.
Have you tried changing the MCPU flag so that the compiler then knows what pipeline you're targeting?
No, I have not done any tests on that. Partly because I'm, you know, I haven't tried mNative and other stuff like that. So.
So the by default.
Okay.
If you specify, if you're requiring AES NI instructions, then that gives you to the number of possible things, and you might end up getting a fairly significant speed up.
Oh, yeah.
Knows what the latency of the throughput of those instructions are, which Intel is fairly good at contributing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, like, there's an instructions manual out there that has most of the latencies and throughputs on most of
that.
Okay. 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 Yeah. Yeah. And actually, if you do your world compile with the appropriate ones, it should automatically be picked up. Yes.
Have you thought about potential performance improvements by going to the 256-bit
SSE
stuff?
So I've seen those, and I have not actually really looked very much. Part of the thing is I don't think there's going to be any, at least for AES. There's not going to be any performance. I mean, yes, we could probably do two LFSR cranks at the same time, but considering it's only 5 instructions to run it now, so okay, we'd be saving 5 instructions, most of them pipeline. So, and
I was thinking that one thing you might save though is that the internal pipeline inside the processor is wider than 64 bits, right? So it fetches a ton of stuff, cache, and once, so you might gain improvement that way.
I have not thought about using loads that way. The other thing is that I also want to make sure this code runs on as many processors as possible, and there's using the wider 256 or even the 512-bit registers that are coming up soon would be interesting. So, yes?
You might have mentioned this in the presentation, but have you tried this on I386 architecture? Yes.
Well, I haven't actually done any of my performance testing, but I have verified that all of this works on I386 and stuff.
Are you looking at any other processors that you might try
to work this to? Well, so there are, I do know that some of the other processors do have AES instructions, but I haven't looked at them yet. Partly lack of time, and I mean, this all came out because I wanted my storage system to actually perform at a decent era, and so I haven't had those. Yes?
I want to pick up on the idea, have you pushed the results in OpenSSL, so are people aware that you can achieve this performance improvement?
So,
make it their problem.
So actually OpenSSL, as I mentioned earlier, they actually use basically Perl scripts to generate raw assembly, so they actually are getting that performance. And as if you remember the slide way back, here, let me pull up this slide. this slide, you can actually see, you know, with CBC decrypt and XTS, we are almost getting, you know, 3.5-4 gigabytes per second. So there, and that's as at, in my testing on my code in userland, I'm not, it's been a while since I did that. I was only getting about 2.2 to 2.4 gigabytes. So as you can see, there's actually a significant gap even between my XTS code and OpenSSL. So, all right. What? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I do some ARM work as you probably know, and so yeah, I just haven't. None of my ARM boards work the way that I want them yet, so I haven't been able to do much with them. So, all right.
We promised some ARM V8 silicon
soon. Ah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. I can only imagine since it's so new. All right. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you for coming. Hope you have a good.